Greetings, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Ian Punnett in for George Norrie on a fun Friday night. To the hostile alien armies hovering silently outside of the Earth's atmosphere, hiding behind their cloaking devices, remember, eat the Canadians first. Although I will say, I made a pretty darn good poutine this week, and I thought of all of our Canadian listeners. This had come up before. So I was pretty proud of this poutine. I put it on Twitter. I think I did. I took a picture of it. Maybe I didn't put it up. Anytime you want to keep in touch with the show when I'm on, it's at Deacon Punnett on Twitter. And this is like the perfect storm for me, and I'm not making a flippant comment about what's happening on the Gulf Coast. We all know that Hurricane Delta is in the Delta. And so far, the reports are about a 500,000 people are without power. You probably heard that in your top of the hour news. There had been, obviously coming in the middle of the night, we won't know till the morning about everything about destruction or, and praying against loss of life or injury. It did come to shore in a good way, if that's possible, in a better way than it could have been. And so some of the meteorologists were saying this was a best possible case for a Cat 3 hitting in the Gulf Coast. But the rain is slamming already. Flash floods are happening, and that is going to be the bigger danger. And there are lots of trees down, and it's going to be a long night for people who are without power. If you're listening to Coast AM on a battery-operated radio of some sort, trust me when I say we'll give you something else to think about. We're not going to go heavy tonight. There's no politics in the show. We'll do open lines later on, but we'll keep it light with a subject that's fairly pop culture-y for tonight, and I'll tell you about that in a second. First, heads up on tomorrow. It was just a few weeks ago when we had on ML Behrman, who lives in the Mojave and tells his Mojave stories on YouTube and here on Coast to Coast AM and in his books. And he had found a series of photos of footprints in the Mojave when he was actually looking for something else. And he found them in two different places. He took photos of them. We posted them. And then we had a discussion about the idea of Yeti, of Sasquatch, of Bigfoot being somewhere out in the Mojave. And we had heard confirmation from a lot of other people saying this is nothing new. And in fact, cryptozoological experts wrote to me through Twitter and sent me some DMs, which I thought were very interesting, about other proof in the past. We couldn't get the expert that we rely on the most here on Coast to Coast, Jeff Meldrum, I believe was out on assignment or something for one of his Idaho state duties. And so we couldn't get him. But we've got him tomorrow night in the first hour, and we're going to have him look at those photos, and we'll hear live what his reaction is to what ML Behrman had found out in the sands of the Mojave Desert. And then we'll talk about Mexican slavery. Robert Gleason is a prolific author, and he writes about all sorts of stuff, frequently in novel form, but his novels are all steeped in his own historical and or contemporary research. And it's just something you don't hear a lot about. It happened. A larger question maybe lurking out there is it still happening? Mexican slavery coming up on Saturday night on Coast to Coast. But for tonight, we're going to talk with a music historian about the relevance, the importance of Eddie Van Halen, who we lost this week. 2020 continues to plague us, taking some of our favorite performers, and Eddie Van Halen would certainly qualify for that for me. All of our bumpers will be Van Halen. I won't even, you only have to, like, people were, after Eddie Van Halen died, people were tweeting me saying, well, I know what your bumpers are going to be on Friday night. Exactly right. But we're going to talk about him. It's not like his life was full of mystery, but there were some very interesting aspects of his life that perhaps the general public don't know about. Fans do. And then we're also, I asked whether he would look into a subject which has come up a couple of times, and I haven't heard it addressed sufficiently, and that is the mystery surrounding the death of Bon Scott, the original lead singer for AC/DC. AC/DC is reformed. They're getting back together again, and they're going to tour with a couple of the original members and, of course, Brian Johnson, who took over for Bon Scott. But how did he die? What exactly were the circumstances? It's as mysterious as the Jimi Hendrix death, or maybe even Jim Morrison's. And we'll get to that coming up along with our discussion about Eddie Van Halen. But first, the top three stories from this week that appeared on the Coast to Coast AM website. Tim Banal, who is the news editor-in-chief, is covering that, and we'll find out what he thinks the top three stories are next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Saying hi to Alex Miller, Drunken Scoundrel, Clay Crump, Rick Johnson, and everybody else who's logging in tonight at Deacon Punnett Online. Tim Banal follows me regularly on Twitter. And if you've noticed lately, Tim, I've been posting a lot more recipes and photos of the creations I'm making at night. I can't help it. I don't somehow cooler temperatures in the fall have called me back to the kitchen. And so I made a great chicken cacciatore this week. I don't know if you saw the photo.
Is this the beginning of the Ian Punnett lifestyle brand?
No, but somebody suggested that we do a Coast to Coast AM cookbook, and I said, I'm in. If anybody wants to do that, I'll do my part. I'd love to see what George and Tom and whatever everybody else comes up with It would be cool. All right, so we got three big stories. You covered a lot more than that this week, and there's so much heavy stuff going on in the news and a lot of anxiety. So let's get to something fun. We'll start with the what story you want to lead with, if you want to.
Well, yeah, we'll start out with the one here in Tennessee that we posted today at the Coast to Coast AM website. Very strange incident in Tennessee, and we'll get progressively lighter as the story goes.
Good. Well, this is weird, though. I saw this story.
Yeah. I love these police reports that come in, and you only get kind of half the details, and you have to put your mind what caused all this. A man in Tennessee, folks, he's accused of causing a staggering $30,000 in damage to a cemetery. This all happened earlier this week. Cops in Knoxville were called out to the cemetery, and they arrived there, and they discover all kinds of broken gravestones, which is, I guess, par for the course, right, with graveyard vandalism, but also puzzling holes that have been dug in the ground, which is very weird, right? Fortunately, it didn't take long for them to crack the case. They're led to the witness by a witness to a man named Danny Frazier, and they interview him, and he promptly admits that, yes, he was the man behind all of this chaos at the cemetery. And the reason for this was that he was trying to resurrect his grandmother, who passed away 8 years earlier and is buried there. So he ended up being charged.
Did he say why? I mean, did they know why?
No. He never said why, and he never said, or at least the police didn't confer that to the public, why or how he planned to make this happen. So he's in trouble, of course, as one might imagine, $30,000 in damage to the cemetery. He's been charged with felony counts of vandalism and trespassing. And it really left me wondering, along with the questions that you had, how would he explain this to his meemaw if he was successful in resurrecting her? Because she could not possibly have been happy to see what he had done to bring her back to life.
I would think it would have to be a very good reason. You can't bring Meemaw back to life and then just say, in the family egg salad recipe, is it paprika? Is it black pepper or both? I can't remember. I mean, you better have a really good reason for dragging her out of her eternal rest, I would think. She wouldn't be too happy about it. But that's not so scary in one sense. As long as the holes that the police found in the ground were starting on the top and going down instead of on the bottom and coming up. That would be really scary.
That would be worrisome, yeah.
All right, so then what else do we have?
All right, next, I guess this is sort of like, you can call it almost an annual public service announcement here. We're in the Halloween season, which means we're in creepy clown season.
Yes.
And we had a big sighting in the creepy clown front this week in North Dakota, of all places, a rarity for creepy clown incidents.
Well, they're still franchising. You know, I mean, they're bound to get to NoDak someday, but
exactly.
Most franchises don't start off there, so they got to work their way up.
Yes. Well, they've arrived in Fargo, folks. Roxanne Salonen and her son were playing tennis last Saturday night under the lights. It was about 8:30 at night. And they noticed that there were people watching them pressed up against the fence. And they sort of did a little double take because they were standing perfectly still. They weren't really sure, kind of ignored it. Then they looked again, and the people started moving, and they realized they were all wearing clown masks. There were four of these clowns hanging around at the fence. I guess I looked it up. It would be called the pratfall of clowns.
Is that what it is? Is that what it's called? A gathering? It's called the pratfall of clowns. I like that.
So this pratfall of clowns, as if this all isn't creepy enough, right? This pratfall of clowns, they start chanting and moving towards Roxanne and her son. So I guess the kryptonite to creepy clowns, as we all know, is simply phoning the cops.
Right.
Called the police, and the clowns took off. And when Roxanne talked to the Fargo Police Department, they were told she was told that she wasn't the first person to encounter the pratfall of clowns. So they're running around Fargo possibly as we speak, and given the Halloween season, they could be coming to a town near you. So be on the lookout, folks.
Or Election Day, and have them be poll watchers. Nobody would try anything. If you had a creepy clown as the poll watcher, everybody would be on our best behavior, I think.
Absolutely.
All right, and last story.
All right, this is, you know, thank goodness for the Internet, another one of these wonders of the Internet. An online ad in Russia on the equivalent of Craigslist is advertising what is described as a wish-granting cat. And this magical feline, the owner of the magical feline, is asking for big bucks in return for the creature. The cat is named Vizek, and according to his owner, Elena, she was in need of an apartment, and lamenting her situation, she turned to the cat and said, "Fulfill my wish." And miraculously, the next day, she had a feeling that it would come true, and a month later, she had an apartment.
Okay.
So she tried this. I know, it's all very it's all great Internet ads, right?
I'll go with that, sure. Okay, yeah. And then?
So then she put the wish-granting abilities to the test later, and a family member's got new apartments and new cars. But in a tale as old as time, of course, it seems that the cat can only grant three wishes. So now she's put it up for sale on the Russian equivalent of Craigslist for 10 million rubles, which translates to, get this, $127,000 American.
Okay, so not a great exchange rate, but okay. But so that seems unfair to the cat. The cat did its job, right? I mean, you think, like, and they'll be passing this cat off every time somebody burns up their wishes. And I guess those wishes have to be apartments and cars, right? They can't do, it seems to be his wheelhouse.
It would seem to be that.
I love that. Well, if only the guy in Tennessee had bought that cat instead of digging around in the graveyard. Could have wished his meemaw back to life, because, you know, nothing ever goes wrong when people do that. So when they use a cat to get somebody out of the grave, that always works. So, all right. Well, thank you, Tim. Appreciate that. Love those stories. We'll be following new ones all the time at coasttocoastam.com. And I'm excited. You know, I put in a call. This is never going to happen. So I will just tell you this completely upfront. This is never going to happen. But I have a very good friend. Well, he's a very nice man to me anyway, and I'd like to consider him a good friend. And he had once offered that if I needed to, I could ask and see whether or not he could get Sammy Hagar to call in on Coast to Coast some night. So I thought tonight would be a good night. I don't think it's going to happen because it didn't materialize until later on in the week. But several people had asked me about that online and said, hey, any chance you could get Sammy to talk about the death of Eddie Van Halen? So I did try, and maybe something like that could materialize. It'd be a lot easier if I had a magic cat around. In the meantime, Michael Christopher will do just fine. The website is thechroniclesofmc.com, where he loves to share his knowledge as a music historian. Good evening, Michael.
Ian, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for reaching out to the producers and making yourself known.
Absolutely.
Because this is fortuitous. We always like to talk about important people and their passing. And on a Friday night like this, it's a good time for a little off-speed pitch anyway. And Eddie Van Halen was too young, obviously, but it's somebody who smoked a lot. You hate to see that because you know almost inevitably that something could happen like this, esophageal or lung cancer or mouth cancer could come from it, and that's what took him. He fought it pretty hard, but it didn't go his way any longer than the 5 years since his diagnosis. But I think you've been following his life, and as a music historian, I think you could explain better than I about his impact on popular music in general, but particularly rock and roll.
Right. I think that what Eddie did was he revolutionized guitar playing. He changed the way that it was played for generations. When his band put out their first record, Van Halen 1, in February 1978, there was this period in music, especially rock music, where you had bands like Led Zeppelin and the Stones and the Eagles, where they were getting a little too big for themselves. They were a little too self-absorbed, some would say bloated. And you had punk rock coming in on the back end from England and then over in the States with the Ramones. And that's coming in with these big attitudes. And then you have this little band from Pasadena who kind of blended the best of both of these genres, and they just destroyed everything in their wake. You have Eddie with his guitar solo Eruption, putting it as the second track on Van Halen 1, and that's something that was unheard of for a band to focus on the guitarist that
right.
soon on a record. And it's 102 seconds of bending, obliterating all preconceived notions about how a guitar should sound, and it's funnily enough, it's the only flaw on the record and one that nagged at Eddie for his whole life. He claims that he made a little bit of a mistake at the very top end of it.
Hmm.
But, you know, people are feeling this loss so much because I think that Eddie Van Halen was the last great rock star guitarist on stage running around doing his flying Eddies. I mean, this is the guy who used to run up the amps on stage to find gravity while playing guitar.
I think you can make an argument for him being the grandfather of it. I don't know that he's the last, and we can get more into that a little bit later on. But I will tell you, I've been a Van Halen fan since that album came out, but I think one of the things that interests me most, and what people, not everybody, realizes, is that he was self-taught. Although he was somewhat classically trained in some respects in music in general, but he was not on the guitar. The sounds that he made from a guitar came from somewhere deep inside of him.
Right. Well, his dad, John, was a Dutch pianist. And this led Eddie and his brother Alex, they were classically trained on piano. Now, they came to the States when Eddie was really young. I think he was 6 or 7 years old.
Right. That's what I heard.
They came from the Netherlands. He couldn't speak a word of English, and so he's a total outcast to begin with, along with his brother. And most people know the story. It's pretty well known that Eddie started on drums and Alex started on guitar, and they switched up because Alex was a lot better on guitar, on drums. And Eddie would just sit in his room and practice for hours on end. He was totally self-taught. I mean, the family wasn't rich by any means, and not only couldn't they afford a teacher if they wanted to, but he couldn't communicate the language anyway. And he was just obsessed with learning this instrument and just getting these sounds of it that he had never heard before.
Well, I think that's in that way he reminds many of us of Mozart, who was a genius at his instrument at an early age, just by trying to get the sounds that he had heard in his head out onto a piece of paper, just to make real what was something which he was imagining. And I think that's what you can really feel by when you listen to Eddie Van Halen. And I think this is part of the magic of Van Halen as well, because he didn't just ignite a new rock sound, and I think you were right in saying Led Zeppelin had gotten kind of bloated. They were ripping off. I love Led Zeppelin, but they're one of the great ripoff bands of all time.
Absolutely.
Right. And I love the Rolling Stones, but they were kind of mailing in some of those albums, and so it had already was rock had needed this kind of thing, and this is what started that whole Southern California sound. Right. This is the Sunset Strip. These are bands that were cutting their teeth on these rock clubs in LA, and they kicked open the door for so many bands that came after them.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you had these bands like Quiet Riot with Randy Rhoads in the band, who would then go on, of course, to be in Ozzy Osbourne's group. You had bands like Rat, all these groups, Dokken, and these bands that were playing on the Sunset Strip back in the 80s or the late 70s, early 80s. But what their guitarists, and they all have some great guitarists, what they lacked was the feel that Eddie had. And something that I've always noticed about Eddie Van Halen throughout his entire career was you rarely...
You're going to have to hang on to that thought so we can come back to it. So stand by, and we'll talk a little bit more about Eddie Van Halen and then the mystery of Bon Scott on the way on Coast to Coast. I was reminded of Panama the other day. Perhaps you were too. The song that was played outside of the Imperial headquarters of... Manuel Noriega, remember that during the whole, the whole Contra thing? And we had his official residence under siege, and they were playing Panama from Van Halen over and over and over again, which apparently he hated. Not as bad as the story, though, that reminded me of it earlier this week. The Oklahoma County District Attorney was... involved in a story in which inmates were forced to listen to the children's song Baby Shark. Baby Shark. Baby Shark. And it was considered cruel and inhuman. and they're totally right on that. And if they had played Baby Shark outside of Noriega's place, he would have come out a lot faster. All right, so we're talking about the legacy of Eddie Van Halen, and we were just making the point before the bottom of the hour that in so many ways we can't quite understand the impact that somebody like an Eddie Van Halen has had, because we're still too close to the story. He was here with us, he's now gone. Some people were not rock fans or metal fans, would never have, quite appreciated him anyway. But the same could be true of Mozart. And it took a long time. When Mozart died, I mean, there was mourning and whatever, but it wasn't what we know later, right? It wasn't like suddenly the importance of that self-taught, that brilliant, not entirely self-taught, but the kid who was writing compositions on his own at such an early age, that his true relevance to the history of music wasn't known until much later, long after his death. I think the same will be true for Eddie Van Halen, and we'll get back to that coming up in just a second. If you're at coasttocoastam.com just for fun, go take a look at some of the wonderful things that we put up there for you, all the stories that Tim Banal was talking about earlier. You're going to love the bumpers tonight, and we'll get to the Bon Scott story coming up too on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. The Chronicles of Michael Christopher is available at coasttocoastam.com. Just link up to him through our guest page for tonight. You'll see him writing about not just Van Halen, but all sorts of things regarding music history. And so I go back to this point, though, Michael, which is that we are just still, I think, appreciating what he did and his unique genius. And also for the fact that, oddly enough, and this doesn't happen very much in music, where he really started a band along with his brother, and that band survived a couple of major lineup changes over the years and still kept producing popular and worthy music.
Right. I think that over the years he had some issues with singers because he didn't really care about the vocalist or really the lyrics. He couldn't care less what they were singing about. At his core, he was a fan of the power trio. He was obsessed with Eric Clapton, but only the Cream era. And he loved the sound of the album Live Cream. And I think if it were up to him, he would be happy just playing with his brother Alex and later his son Wolfgang on bass. That was the ideal for him.
And you got Michael Anthony, who was obviously terrific. And what is interesting about that power trio thing, I think, is that some people have argued that that's the purest form of rock, in the sense that, like a triangle replicates a pyramid, it's sturdy from every direction. And if all three performers are equally yoked, you get these amazing albums like Cream, or you get the work of people like Van Halen, with or without a lead singer like David Lee Roth. But when David Lee Roth left, and I happen to be a fan of the Sammy Hagar period too, I think that was much to his credit as well, that the band's sound changed. I mean, there's no denying how it changed, but it was cool in kind of a whole new way. And that's like never happens.
Right. And there were two main differences between Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth. The first is that Sammy Hagar is miles away a better singer. And the other is that Dave is a better lyricist by leaps and bounds than Sammy is. But with Sammy, Eddie felt that he could express himself more through his musical training, and the band incorporated a lot more keyboards into the group. Eddie was, of course, still able to shred. I mean, you listen to all those records that he did with Sammy, he's still ripping it up on guitar. But so many of those songs, I mean, you hear a song like When It's Love, the ballad, or Right Now, of course, they're all led by the keyboards and the piano.
Well, that and Love Walks In, which I'll be popping on later on as a bumper too, which I just happen to think is an amazing melody. But what's interesting about that is that Sammy Hagar was no slouch on the guitar either. I was a fan of him back in the Red days. You know, I remember him kind of when he was breaking. And so that was an interesting confluence that they were able to put together. What something wasn't really considered a super group, it was Sammy Hagar has taken over the lead, but he could play guitar not like Eddie, but he wasn't a bad lead guitar player on his own.
Right. Well, Sammy Hagar, of course, he was around one of the best teachers someone could have, and that's Ronnie Montrose when he was in the band Montrose.
Right. I love that.
What a great band.
Yeah. I love Montrose's version of Town Without Pity.
That's a great version of that.
Oh, my God. I love that song.
But when Sammy came into Van Halen, he was already a well-established solo artist, and he was playing he was playing arenas. And when he joined up with the band, it was pretty exciting for a lot of people, because it was in a way like a supergroup. You had this well-established singer. They didn't just find a nobody. It wasn't like AC/DC when they found Brian Johnson, and it was somebody who's that guy? It's everybody knew I Can't Drive 55. Everybody knew Three Lock Box.
Right.
And it freed up Eddie with Sammy's guitar playing. It freed up Eddie to explore different textures within his own music and within his own band.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I like how you're talking about that. There's no mystery surrounding the death of Eddie Van Halen. I mean, this was semi-predictable in a sad way, especially when you see those early photos of the band, and there's Eddie Van Halen with that distinctive cigarette stuck on his lower lip while he's playing, you know, for hours on end.
Right.
And I mean, you hate to see it, you hate to think about that, but it's a good reminder that there are, you know, health implications that come from smoking, and this is one of those. It ends people's lives too early, too often. But what is interesting to me is that there was a kind of he was able to capture some real chemistry in his lifetime that not many people do. And in that, even with those lineup changes, he was able to come up, at least for several albums at a time with other performers, some pretty unique sounds through that chemistry. And that's the mystery that's so elusive, because so many other bands could never pull it off. I mean, when Freddie Mercury died, I mean, Queen still tours, and there's been a couple of people in the lead position, and that's kind of cool, but it'll never be Queen. And it was still Van Halen, even with Sammy Hagar as lead vocalist.
Right. Especially when you have the guitarist who is the centerpiece of the band, it's really hard to find a great band to get around him. There's dozens of phenomenal guitarists out there, but they never find the great band to surround themselves with. And Eddie was able to do that twice which is, it's unheard of in music. And again, he had to grow a lot with Sammy Hagar, and I think that that contributed to the longevity of the band. They were able to survive the influx of grunge music because they didn't sound like a band from the Sunset Strip. They didn't sound like a hair metal band.
Yeah.
It was a constant evolution within the group.
That's true. Yeah, I love that. In fact, that's a really good point because there were so many Van Halen wannabe bands that came out, and they were good. They had an album or two and always a couple of good tracks. And, you know, I'm always game for a little Great White every so once in a while, or Rat, or, you know.
You're throwing some round and round, you've got me all in. But there's
right.
a big difference with Eddie and all those other guitarists in those bands. You never saw him without a guitar in his hands. And by all accounts, he wasn't really comfortable without it in his hands. And that's how he chose to speak to people, not through interviews or coming up to the microphone during concerts. And when the band wasn't on the road or on the stage, 90% of the time, Eddie would be in the studio or in his hotel room practicing. Now, he did his share of partying, and that's well documented.
Oh, yeah.
He was most at home with his guitar, and I think that's one of the things that separated him from other musicians who were watching the clock in the studio, waiting for the time and air to end so they could get out, go to the clubs, experience their fandom. They wanted to get all their accolades from being famous, and I really don't think Eddie cared much for that. He cared about the music.
We're talking with music historian Michael Christopher. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Everything you said is true. I think what's interesting to point out, though, is that I met him a couple of times. Did you ever meet him?
Well, no. I met him in 1998, but it was in one of those backstage kind of cattle call things where you go up, do the quick meet and greet, get a picture with a bunch of people that you don't even know, and then you move on. So you get to say something like, thank you very much for the music, and move along. Next.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I had, too, although I was the morning host on a rock station at the time, so I got a little bit more time, but it was very much like the same thing. And somebody asked me on Twitter about this tonight, and I told them that my memory of every time I met the Sammy Hagar led Van Halen backstage was just how nice they were. And they were never, I mean, I've been backstage all my whole life, right? And I mean, it got to a point where it was just another day at the office. As cool as it is to meet famous people and get autographs and whatever, and I'm as dopey as the next guy, but here we were all geeking out because it was when Eddie Van Halen walked into the room, and he was just perfectly nice about it. Introverted, but he didn't make anybody feel uncomfortable for the fawning. And that's, I measure somebody's worth on that. I don't know if everybody's had that same experience, but that's how I will remember it. And I saw it happened twice. So I had a feeling.
So much about Eddie Van Halen that he would almost go out of his way to make people feel more comfortable around him because he knew what it was like. He knew what it was like to sit there and be in the presence of one of your idols and freak out a little bit. But he wanted to make whoever it was, whether it was a fan coming up to meet him for the first time or some guitarist that was even very well known on his own. I mean, there's legions of guitarists out there who are well known by their first and last name that they were quaking in their boots when they first met him. And he was just as kind as could be with them.
Yeah, like Joe Satriani, Steve Vai. I mean, some other people are pretty darn good. And, you know, people forget, like, he also had a little bit of fun with doing the whole thing, the Beat It solo, right? And working with Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. That seems so out of place.
Well, he knew Quincy Jones, and that's one of those great stories in rock and roll where Quincy Jones called up Eddie, and he said, hey, Eddie, it's Quincy. And Eddie said, Quincy who? He said, it's Quincy Jones. And Eddie hung up the phone on him.
Quincy
called back, and he said, hey, it really is Quincy. And he said, what do you want? He's like, look, I'm producing Michael Jackson's new album. You know, he did the album Off the Wall. He's got this new album that I'm working on, and I'd like you to come down and maybe play a guitar solo or something on it. And he goes, yeah, no problem, Quincy. I'll come down. I'd be honored to come down and work with you. And because Michael Jackson at that point wasn't Michael Jackson. So Eddie...
Well, Off the Wall was pretty big, but it didn't blow up like Thriller did. I mean, you got to remember, it was already a number one album on R&B and pop charts. But I'll go with you on a Thriller was a whole new level. That's just all there is to it.
Yeah, that's just worldwide, into the stratosphere. You could go into some cave somewhere and somebody had the Thriller record.
Right.
But when Eddie did go into the studio to work on the track that became Beat It, he just did two improvised solos. They kind of melded the two of them together, and that was it. Walked out, and he was finished. Never got a dime for it, never asked for one, and it went on to become one of the biggest selling pop singles of all time.
Well, and the album is still number one. The album, yep. Right? I believe Thriller is still the number one selling single album, not double album, but the number one selling single album.
Yes, it is. It is, and that's one of those things where you just marvel and say, wow, and he didn't get a dime for playing on that record.
Yeah.
And he really didn't care. I think an even funnier thing was that the band was off the road at the time. Van Halen was off the road. They were all doing their own things. He didn't think anyone would ever know. He thought that, no one's ever going to hear this. And there was a story where a couple weeks after the record came out, when Beat It came out, David Lee Roth had pulled into a 7-Eleven, pick up some soda or whatever before he was going to the studio, and he heard Beat It blasting out of somebody's car. And he said, this guitarist, he's ripping off Eddie. He sounds just like Eddie. And he got to the studio. He was fuming. He said, you wouldn't believe it. Michael Jackson has this guy on his record. He sounds just like you. And Eddie, bashfully kind of said, well, David, it is me. That's me on there. And they said, all right, well, what did we get for it? How much money did you make?
That's so David Lee Roth.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention, in an odd sort of way, everybody always accused David Lee Roth of selling out all the time, right? That he gave up on his rock roots. And even though Eddie Van Halen cut that solo, he never suffered that. It was always, in a way, because I was working in hard rock radio at the time, and it was always viewed the other way around, that he elevated Michael Jackson, not he lowered himself to perform on an R&B record or a non-metal album.
That's really interesting that you've mentioned that, because it would be looked at, if it was anybody else, that, what are they doing? They're taking a step down by going into this other genre. And what it did was that brought Michael Jackson to the rock audience. That brought him to the audience that might not be into his music. And all of a sudden they start thinking, wow, well, this Michael Jackson guy, he must be pretty cool. He's got Eddie Van Halen play on his record. He's got Paul McCartney on there. And we should give this guy a chance. And that's the rock world. And then next thing you know, he transcends all genres. And a lot of that has to do with Eddie Van Halen.
I'll tell you a true story. So I was working, it was just before I came to work for a hard rockin' station in the Quad Cities, in the QCA. So Davenport, Bettendorf, Rock Island, Moline, East Moline, Milan. There was a radio station there, 97X, and I loved going to work there, but it was recovering. When I got there, it was recovering. And it was recovering from having given away its reputation, partly because they lost their way as a rock station, and their ratings plummeted and whatever. But part of that was because they were playing on a hard rock station. They were playing Beat It. And this was hard for some fans when the whole format was kind of based around rock. It was sort of like, Eddie could do that for Michael Jackson, but Michael Jackson doesn't deserve to be on rock stations. So they looked at it in this sort of way, and they finally had to come out with a very public apology, including a TV campaign, if I remember correctly, saying, hey, look, sorry about that. No more Michael Jackson on 97X. But that just goes to show you the power of Eddie Van Halen and how people were, they loved to hear that solo. It's just the station got a little carried away and put it in rotation, and they should never have done that. That was like, but that's how what a big deal it was at the time.
Yeah, I don't think any other artist could have crossed over with the way that Michael Jackson did into, or at least have the programmers try and cross him in. Yeah, look at somebody like Prince, who, God, we could talk for hours about how he was. But a song like Let's Go Crazy, as rocking as that is, you're not going to put that on a rock station. But if you have Eddie Van Halen on a track, well, let's try this. Now, obviously, it didn't work in that case, but it gave him the impetus to try something like that.
Love that. You're right. All right. So, but then what's the second biggest selling single rock album in history? Do you know what it is, Michael Christopher?
That's putting me on the spot.
I think it's Back in Black. I think
Back in Black is the best-selling hard rock album of all time.
I think it's right behind Thriller and Units Sold. But that's the perfect transition because I want to ask you about the Bon Scott mystery. I think we handled Eddie Van Halen sufficiently, but I do want to talk about the real story behind the death of Bon Scott. What's that mystery about next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett.